Sleep no longer, friends. Wake up. You get the blessing of Guns N' Roses. Why do we do rock and roll to start this show, Bob?
Well, help people get out of bed just in case. This is the first thing they hear. Turn that up, Lori.
This is a song Paul and Marge want to love.
Yeah. We would have never picked that song, actually, if we didn't have a younger guest today. But Welcome to the Jungle. By the way, you know our buddy Jeff Crump?
Yeah.
Jeff used to be the road manager for Guns N' Roses.
And, guy's done a little of everything.
He has. And I remember because one day after he was finished doing that, they came into town for a concert, and kind of their main guy, their manager, whatever, wanted to play golf at, I think, at Cherry Hills. And somehow we arranged for Jeff and him to play golf, and it was a day of a full solar eclipse. And when they got out there, the manager said, oh, no. He said, Axl Rose is so dumb, he'll be blind by tonight.
Oh, brother. That fit right in with the club, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So this is You Get the Blessing. I'm Bo Mitchell. That's Bob Belts, the world's smartest man and best Bible teacher in history and my partner in this program. And what we try to do each week is bless you by introducing you to members of this community that are impacting lives for Christ and just doing great things in their own lives. So today we get to finally meet this guy we've heard about for, I don't know, a couple years at least, but from Providence Bible Church, Pastor Jason Jantz. So Jason, it's a pleasure to finally meet you face to face because Tim Griffin and Jeff Cromendyke love you.
Well, great to be here. Good to meet you.
Ben Warwick thinks you're okay. Not love, just sort of okay.
So tell us a little bit about where you were born, what was it like around your home growing up, and how you first encountered a personal relationship with Christ.
Born in the Midwest in Green Bay, Wisconsin. So I'm a Packer fan to this day.
And, good choice this year.
Yeah, for several years in the last.
Oh, yeah.
Are you going to buy
they
stock?
Did win it last year.
You see they're selling stock.
I don't buy
in the
stock,
team.
But I got the cheese head. I got a cheese cowboy hat. I got a cheese tie.
You
got
to buy like one share or something, you know.
So family, my dad was became a Christian out of alcoholism when I was probably two, so I pretty much only have known a Christian home. Very, you know, got into a small church there, and then my dad's business collapsed during the tax cuts of the 80s. He had a commercial flooring business, did a lot of government contracts, lost everything, wanted to get a fresh start, so moved out to Denver, Colorado, where he had honeymooned. I was 12 at the time.
When he honeymooned? No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. And so moved out here and been here for 26 years in the town, and joined a Baptist church in the suburbs and was a member there for 23 years. And then 4 years ago left to go downtown to start a church in the heart of the city. That's the nutshell.
So you felt all along that God was going to use you in a way like this, or how did you?
That's a great question. I don't know if it's always great to look back in hindsight, but I would say I had a bout with poverty probably the time I was 8 till I was 12 or 13. And so I think that really impacted me because poverty has an impact on you as a kid, as an adult too. But my dad had a bus ministry. He used to take kids to church on a bus and pick up kids in the city and stuff. So I think I rode most of my life to church on a bus and just developed a heart for that type of ministry. But then, you know, it was at my ninth grade year where I found Christ for myself was when I got kicked out of high school. And so my parents put me in homeschool, and I had a friend who basically just looked at me and said, "Do you know the Lord?" And I was like, "Oh, yeah, I've prayed the prayer 25 times, even when I'm not sure, you know." And but I was doing a paper out on the west side, and one morning at 6 o'clock, I just got tired of running, and I just looked up at the sky and said, "God, save me." That's all I did. Didn't tell anybody for 3 years. And then I was heading off into ministry school, and I thought, well, I probably ought to get baptized. So I went and told my pastor. I said, you know, I've became a believer 3 or 4 years ago, and now I'm getting ready to go into ministry. And I think God was prepping my heart for ministry even before I was saved, if that sounds kind of weird. But I just always felt like I would give my life to do something like that, even though I didn't want to. Being raised in poverty, you know, I saw missionaries walk through in plaid sport coats and high water pants, and I thought, that's the last thing I want to do. You know, beg people for money and
never
have enough.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah. I know I'm speaking to a little different demographic, but anyway, so I just surrendered. I was at a summer camp, and Hellfire Brimstone preacher kind of talked about living for others instead of yourself, and I thought kind of broke me of my materialistic ambitions and went into ministry. So was a youth pastor on the west side of town for 11 years and then started working with adults and addiction recovery programs, things like that, and then started a church.
Let's pause here just for a second because we use these words comfortably, and I know exactly what you're saying. But, Bob, when we use the word saved, what are we saying and what are we saved from? And why is it, how does that fit in?
Yeah, it's one of those words that sort of has become, a cliche, although it's a great word when you know what it means. It really means to be delivered from destruction is actually what technically the word means, and it was used in the Old Testament oftentimes to even talk about if an army was getting ready to get crushed by another army, and they would cry out to God, and God would, quote, save them. He'd intervene and save them. And the biggest application of that, and usually what we mean when we talk about it, is that, you know, our lives apart from a relationship with God through Christ, always, frankly, are headed towards some kind of destruction. And when Christ came and died on the cross, rose from the dead, and, you know, gave the opportunity for us to actually have a relationship with him, when, you know, we cry out like Jason did, and, you know, whatever language we use, save me is pretty good language for that when you realize that what your need is. You know, he comes into our life and begins to transform us and make our life something. And the word really, again, in the New Testament, it's used three ways. One is past tense, kind of like have been saved, which means that you've made some sort of a commitment that started this journey that Christ is in your life. But it also is used in the New Testament in an kind of an ongoing present tense where our being saved, which I think talks about the whole process of transformation that the Spirit of God does in our life when we faithfully walk with him. And then it's used in a future tense, you know, will be saved, which looks really toward the coming of Christ and the age to come, and that, you know, with Christ in our life, we've been guaranteed a slot on that bus. So it's a great word when you know what it means, and it's really tragic when it simply becomes a cliche.
This is how I scraped through seminary with a C-minus average, because if I had a question, I would
you
call
cheated
him.
Off, Bob.
I'd call him at home and ask, and I'd get that kind of answer. So I think it's great that you referred to us by guys that I consider very strong individuals, savvy in terms of their businesses and great in terms of their families, and they look at you and say, Jason's got it, and he's sold out to serve the people God's placed in his community.
The spiritual X factor, he's got it. See, that's what they tell us. So
tell us what your day looks like every day, and what are some of the stuff you're doing, because you're obviously great at it.
Yeah, and how did you – tell us a little bit of the story of when you went down to start the church. What, you know, what was going on in your mind, and what did that look like too?
Yeah, I like to kind of reject the X factor kind of thing, or spirit, you know, I think it's hyperbolic type terminology when Romans 12 calls this your reasonable service. Like, even there's books that have come out, one called Radical. My one beef with the book is it should be called Normal. Like, this is what the normal Christian life should be. And so,
yeah, but Watchman Nee already wrote that book, see, so they couldn't use that word.
Right, exactly. But it's a shame when the way a Christian should live is now being called radical, even by those inside the church, because this is what I think is the normal Christian life. But, you know, God just, you know, Jesus was an incarnational person who left heaven's glory and incarnated himself and lived among us, lived like us, lived with us. And so I just felt when God burdened my heart for the city, it would take our incarnational presence. And so we moved from Littleton downtown into the tougher areas of the hood. Now, downtown Denver is not like it was in the 80s, where Five Points was, you never saw a white person in Five Points. It's somewhat gentrifying in the Five Points area, but it's still probably the center of socioeconomic and ethnic diversity there in the city. And so we moved in. We put our kids into the neighborhood public school, which is the worst school in the state of Colorado. It's the only school ever been closed down twice by the State Board of Education. And walked in the first day. Our Senator, Michael Bennett, who is the superintendent, was there on the front steps. And I thought, why is he here? You know, and the news was there. And turns around, this is the second time the school was reopening. And I was the only white guy at the school. And I thought, you know, a third of my neighbors are Anglo. And I thought, where's all my friends, my Anglo friends from my block? Well, they're using their wealth and their power to kind of choice out into better schools. So I looked at my wife and I said, we either made the biggest mistake of our lives or we better get involved. So we just jumped in. I joined the leadership team. She subbed in classrooms. And then that's been a journey. We're now actually work part-time in public education, working for a philanthropist who helps fund education for poor children in the inner city of Denver. That's a long story, too. But
what percentage of your time does that take?
I work about 20 to 25 hours a week in public education, usually reform efforts in public ed, as well as working with my school on helping improve the education for 600 kids there. So I work on the admin team, and so I do a lot of the hiring, kind of the HR stuff, and then administer funds. My boss gives $500,000 a year to our school, so I help administrate where those funds go.
So have you made the right choice? Do you feel good about where your kids are and how it's all working, or does it still make you sometimes step back and think, I've lost my mind?
Oh, you do have those thoughts. I mean, you know, I was just texting downstairs before the show to a gang member because I'm meeting with a Crips gang member and his gang boss here next week. And sometimes I have those crazy thoughts, but, you know, I've had these guys in my home for dinner and stuff, and it's probably not as scary as it is when you're doing it as when you're hearing about it. But, you know, I mean, the week after I met with one of the gang leaders, my home was broken into for the first time. And so I kind of thought, is that related? You know, when my kids are in classrooms where, you know, the teaching is not to the teaching is great, but there's four classrooms going on in an inner city classroom. You got your 2 year behind kids, your 1 year behind kids, your kids who are at grade level and your kids who are advanced. You have four classrooms going on at once in an inner city school. Well, you need the best teachers in the state need to be in those schools. So
just to juggle the complexity.
Just to juggle four classrooms instead of one. So my kids are at or above grade level in their core competencies, which I'm thrilled. But they're getting another type of education too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the one I love our audience getting exposed to today by meeting Jason Jantz, our guest. And it's fascinating that God prepared you for this and plugged you in a place where you can have such influence.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I mean, to some degree, God maybe prepped my heart for it, but he never told me how to do it. I want to make sure that's clear. I don't know what I'm doing. Right? So, well, I mean, that's very
clear. No wonder
clear.
We struck a chord with
that's
you
right.
early.
All right. Right.
And so
the perfect guest.
Yeah, people I always say, if people accuse me of being part of organized religion, I would take it as a huge compliment. Because that's not what happens in our ministry. We're not very organized, but people say, you know, the safest place to be is in the center of God's will. I totally disagree. I think often the will of God and what God has for you might be extremely dangerous and you might get killed. But that's not really the point. I mean, when you signed up for this thing, it was, you know, Paul said, one of the great missionaries, for me to live is Christ, to die is gain. So when you settle the death question, then I think you're free to minister in different contexts.
That sounds like jumping off a cliff, and that's what you're saying we should maybe do, is step way out there and trust God instead of trusting our own moves.
Well, one thing I'll tell you, when you jump off the cliff, it is an exhilarating feeling.
Well, tell us how people can help. What could they do to assist you, or is there a way they can get involved, whether it's writing a check or showing up as a volunteer? Is there anything folks can do?
Well, I fundamentally believe in reciprocity, meaning that, you know, there's over 2,000 texts in the scripture that deal with people in poverty. And the way American demographics have mapped out since post-World War II and the invention of the American suburb, what you've done is you've created a context whereby most believers don't have a context in which to live out some of the most powerful truths in Scripture. For instance, James says, the people who are rich in faith are those who are poor in this world. Really, the people who are rich in this world struggle the most with having strong faith. So you want to learn how to have strong faith, go develop a relationship with a person in poverty. They will teach you many things. And I get the privilege of being in a church that's, you know, 40% below the poverty level, 60% above. And I get to see radical transformation take place in relationship. That is probably what I'm after more than a volunteer or a check.
Come yourself, but get involved and watch your life be transformed.
Yeah, I mean, I think writing a check is fine and coming in and volunteering is fine. But, you know, we have Subarus by the dozen come downtown on Saturday mornings and open up their hatchback and serve burritos to the homeless, okay? I call it drive-by Christianity. Because the homeless know there's four different burrito wagons, and they know which corner to hit. And if you look at our homeless, we have one of the largest homeless populations in the country. They are not skinny. You can get breakfast, lunch, and dinner at seven different places for free every day in Denver. What do they need? And that's the deeper question. They need a relationship with somebody. That's far more costly, I think, sometimes than writing a check or just coming down to volunteer. So I just want to invite the audience to come and engage in relationship. What does that look like? I don't know. Maybe we would put you with a refugee family who just got airlifted out of Tanzania, you know, speaking Swahili, plopped into inner city Denver, and doesn't know how to handle the snow, you know. Maybe it is hooking up with a homeless person or a mom in transition, or some of the ex-cons that come out of prison that are looking for a friend.
I love Craig Redd and that whole ministry, Strong Tower, that you're part of. Or did you launch that?
You know, the Lord launched it. I mean, I left my last church, and I had a year and a half to just plan, raise funds, and build a core team. But I was, for the first time in my life, a shepherd with no sheep, and I just got kind of antsy. And so I planned this trip to this prison. That's a chaplain invited me up, and I went up there, and my heart bled all over that place when I talked to the guys. And I said, man, I'll help you when you get out. You know, write me, I'll write you back. Oh, my mailbox filled up, and I didn't have time to write them back, and I totally – you know, broke my promise to them to write them back, and because I couldn't handle it, the load. So I said, God, you need to send somebody. Second trip, I met Craig Redd. Craig Redd came out of prison, and I, you know, said, Craig, I don't have much to help you, but here's an office cubicle, here's a cell phone, and I'll give you $200 a month out of our general fund.
What'd you identify about Craig that would make you ask him that question and trust that he would follow through with it?
Well, and I hope your listeners appreciate this. I think sometimes the church becomes very bureaucratized, and I want to be a church where you just say yes to people. If they came up and said, I want to do ministry for God, you would fundamentally say yes rather than say, let's run this through a committee. So I'd rather have him try it and fail and learn from it and then pick him back up and help him than to sit there and try to kill everything before it got off the ground.
So the fact he was breathing and available, that was all you needed to know.
And he has great credentials. I mean, he robbed, 12 banks and 4 grocery stores in 10 days? I mean, with no gun. I mean, that's pretty good.
It's a record, I think.
Yeah. So anyway.
That's how Strong Tower got launched.
18 months later, one out of 6 guys coming out of Colorado prisons walked through his door. It's awesome.
It is. I've been down there and witnessed that.
And it's really messy.
So you're almost describing that us suburbanites, in a way, are in prisons ourselves because we just are ignorant to what's going on right down the street from where we live. And the best way we can get involved is to just show up and say, okay, who can I love on and how can I?
And remember reciprocity, that you need that change. Like, you fundamentally need that relationship in your walk in life to help you keep your values straight. We one Sunday, we just turned the mic over to the homeless. It was when the stock market plunged, okay? It just went down, 389 points the other day. We just turned the microphone over to the homeless and said, why don't you preach to us on how we live by faith in down economic times, because you think about this. You've learned how to live by faith in the middle of these tough times. And then we had the homeless come down, the rich come down. We define rich as anybody who lives above the poverty level. The rich come down and let the homeless lay hands on them and pray for them. And the Denver Post was there that day and put that picture on the front page of the Denver Post. I mean, that was the kingdom of God, turning the values of a society upside down, saying these are the people who are rich in faith, and this is what we need. If Jesus came around the water coolers today, the conversation would not be about the stock market. The conversation would not be about investments. And I don't think the conversation would be about Republicans and Democrats. He would say, blessed are the meek. Blessed are the humble. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness. They will be filled.
How would you coach a guy like me that's pastoring a rich church, I guess? I think most of our guys, although right now in this economy, there's people that, you know, are really struggling, obviously, in the suburbs too. But how do you coach a guy like me to try and make that some reality in the context that we're in?
I think you have a very difficult job because, number one, fundamentally being convinced that faith without interaction with the poor can be dysfunctional. So how do I create those contexts? And I think you have to work really hard to create opportunities for relationship to happen. And it can happen, but I think it takes an intentional effort. But I think it'll fundamentally transform any congregation when you have that mix. But I don't think the urban church can pull off what they're trying to pull off without the help of the suburban church. I just want to make sure that we don't frame it in a way that the suburban church just needs to write checks and come do occasional ministry. We need people to mentor homeless people out of the Denver Rescue Mission and create a relationship there. I got a guy right now who lives in the suburb. He comes to our church downtown, and he has a guy who's in our congregation who's homeless, who has an alcohol dependency. And, you know, he was just text messaging me today and saying, you know, addiction is a terrible thing. But, you know, he's got three kids, and he's got this man living in his house, and it is a tough situation. But he's being transformed by that. So I would just say if you can create opportunities for relational engagement between the people of God and his people in needy situations, the rest is just going to take care of itself.
You know, in the mid-80s, Bob and I were part of a church out in the suburbs, and five pastors from the city, Bob Wolfolk, Ken Roberts, Dennis Noble, not sure Dennis was there yet, and Jack LaPietra and Luis Villarreal, kind of
great guys,
and they educated us on, you know, we're tired of, you know, white suburbia lobbing down to the city surplus crumbs that they think we need. I mean, they even gave the example of, not these words exactly, one of the pastors said, you know, we feel like we answer the phone and somebody says, hey, we just got a new baby grand piano for our house, and we'd like to send you our crap out old upright. And then the pastor has to say, oh, great, bring it down. Bring it down, nothing works on the piano. They set it on the lawn, and they have to pay $50 to take it to the dump. So I guess all that is in my mind as you're talking, because I still am more comfortable sending a check or making a reference, or like in my case as Chaplain of the Nuggets, I have a ticket program where I send tickets down and say, you know, go have a fun night at the Pepsi Center and listen to the racket and watch the players. But it is kind of a safety net or something. So even 25 years in, I still don't get it. It's hard for us to get out here what's going on down there, isn't it, without just jumping in and embracing it one at a time?
Yeah, it just relationship transforms everything. I mean, Ruby Payne said in her book, Framework for Understanding Poverty, she said there's no significant change without a significant relationship. That's what the poor need. That's what the rich need. We need significant relationships across class boundaries. And I think there's transformation that takes place. So if anything, today is just an issue to a call to relationship.
This will sound weird, but we've shared this on the program, and God blessed me 21 years ago with a 137-day trip to federal prison. And the night before I left, I was supposed to be picked up the next morning early, and I packed everything I had that I'd been depending on living on for 137 days into a tiny little cardboard box. And I thought, boy, life sure got simple here.
We call those disorienting dilemmas. Yeah. So like 100 of us next Friday night will be sleeping in cardboard boxes downtown to raise money for single moms and fatherless kids. That night, sleeping outside in a cardboard box in the heart of downtown, one block from Crack Triangle right in front of the Rescue Mission, is a disorienting dilemma. When you go through that, you're changed. Yeah. And that was a disorienting dilemma for you.
Amen. I can remember it. And anyway, so give us a phone number and address, something. How can they find Providence Bible Church if they want to jump in?
I don't really even know our church phone number. I'm sorry. Okay. Website, providencedenver.org.
Providencedenver.org, folks. Don't sit back and miss this. You, the name of our show is perfect. You'll get the blessing if you get down there and jump into a transformational relationship.
Very true.
So Pastor Jason Janz, our guest, thank you very much. Bob, incredible, huh?
Yeah, it's great, and I feel challenged, so thanks for coming.
Everything Tim Griffin and Jeff Cromendyke told us about you is true.
Yeah, so. But you don't have the X factor because no one does. We're all just the same, so there.
Blessings, folks. Thanks for tuning in.